to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Good morning, everyone. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today we have a pre-recorded interview for December 20th, 2016. And I have with me today David Gallup of the World Service Authority. Now, before I dive into his extensive resume, I just want to let everyone know that we have truly, truly, deeply, from the core of my being, I am passing on information to you. We have completely gotten to the other side of the tipping point. Anything that you're hearing, anything at all that you are hearing, whether it's galactic wars, whether it's scuffling going on the planet, I'm not denying that that's not going down. What I'm trying to say to you is that momentum is now so amazingly accelerated. We are at an all-time end game here. Please keep holding the space for that. Envision what you want. Do not focus on the amount of distortion that's going on, because this distortion is going to continue to accelerate as well. So as the light continues to gain momentum, the distortion is also going to continue to gain more distortion. So don't focus on that, please. So anyway, as you all know, Galactic Connection is the one of the world leaders for the alternative news, providing you all sorts of different kinds of interviews. And today we have none other than discussing not only world change and how we can really take an active part in that, because I know that's really near and dear to all of our hearts, but I think you'll really enjoy David. Now, many of you are going to say, oh, David's a lawyer. And I'm sure David's heard that in the spiritual circles before, but we're going to talk today. He's quite a different type of lawyer, I feel. I felt this really merited the timing right now of all the changes that are about to take place in 2017. So let me give you a little bit of his background. A little bit. So David is the president of the World Service Authority out of Washington, D.C. It's a global public service human rights organization founded in 1954. And prior to working at the WSA, Mr. Gallup was a legal research consultant conducting research on construction contracts and mechanics liens. And he was also a Dean's Fellow at the Washington College of Law's International Human Rights Law Clinic out of D.C. Now get this, where he researched asylum and international human rights issues, developed and maintained a human rights document library, that was pretty impressive, coordinated a human rights education workshop, and represented asylum applicants. His professional memberships also include, I loved this, Maryland, American, World Jurist, and World Space Bar Associations. I love that. And for 15 years, he was the Secretary of the United Nations Association Task Forces on UN Restructuring and on Cultures of Peace. David has also been he's created publications on topics such as nationalism and terrorists, and he has written several chapters in the United Nations Association report entitled Restructuring the UN to Meet 21st Century Global Needs. Wow, that's awesome. He's also been interviewed all over the place, folks, regarding books, newspapers, magazines, TVs, internet radio shows such as my own, and he's been on The World Tonight. He's been in the Huffington Post Live, BBC, Postmark Africa. I mean, the list goes on. If you want to read more about his background, you can do so up on the internet, and you can go to galacticconnection.com, or you can also reach him at worldservice.org. Okay, that's worldservice.org. He has also spoken most recently on the topic of who are the idealists and realist in international law organizations and policies. And just to give you a little bit of a flavor, these are some of the topics he's spoken about all over the world. World Court of Human Rights, Gary Davis, His Life and Legacy, which we're going to talk about Gary Davis in a minute. World Citizenship, Religion and the Nation State, Facts About World Government, What is World Citizenship? Claiming Your Rights as a World Citizen, The Right to Self-Determination, Local Citizenship Linked to World Citizenship, What is a Human Rights Lawyer, which I know, David, a lot of people want to hear about, World Peace Starts with You, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights for Children and World Citizenship, World Citizenship, World Law and Human Rights. Does everybody get the gist of what this radio show is going to be about? I feel that it is probably one of the most timely and most imperative radio shows to date. So, we're going to go ahead and bring David in, even though he's there. So good morning, David. Thanks for coming.
Good morning, Alexandra. It's so nice to meet you and to speak with you.
You too. It's been a while because we've kind of crossed paths, been on a couple of council calls, and now we're finally doing this. So I would like to, I know there's just a plethora of information about Gary Davis. So let's start with how the World Service Authority even came about. Whose brainchild was it, and how did it come about?
World Service Authority came about a few years after the start of the World Citizenship Movement, and really right after World War II. Gary Davis was a bomber pilot in World War II. His brother was in the Navy. His brother's bomber ship was destroyed in Salerno in Italy, and his brother was killed. Gary enlisted in the Air Force really for revenge, for retribution for his brother's death that impacted him so much, because Gary, as a young man, really found the acting bug had caught him. He loved acting, and he and his brother were going to be a comedy team, and they were going to make movies together. And when his brother was killed, it almost killed the comedy in him, which was really so sad. So he went off into the Air Force. But then once he was actually up in that plane bombing people, it wasn't just the military combatants that he was bombing. He was bombing civilians, women, men, and children. And one of his planes was bombed down, and he was interned at an internment camp, which he escaped from. And when he came back to the United States. Of course, he was considered a war hero for all that he had done, but he couldn't live with himself. He was totally disillusioned with the whole war system, the nation state system that forced him to put on a uniform and then to kill legally, because when you're wearing a military uniform, you are in this world today, under international humanitarian law, you are allowed to kill another human being, and it is not considered murder.
Right.
That's a problem in itself, Alexandra. So when he came back, he said, I have to do something. He had what we would call today post-traumatic stress syndrome. Back then they called it shell-shocked. So he didn't know what to do with his pent-up emotions and frustrations and anger about the loss of his brother. So he had heard about a young man who went to Germany to rebuild all the churches that had been destroyed in the bombings. And that man basically gave up his citizenship just to build churches, or rebuild churches. And Gary said, well, this is interesting. So he took the little money that he could get from his father, who was actually a very wealthy orchestra leader who had conducted symphony jazz orchestras for all the way from New York down to D.C. He was centered in Philadelphia, but he even played at, I don't know, four or five different presidential inaugurations, including Kennedy's inauguration, his father's orchestra. So he borrowed a little money from his father, flew to Paris, and one of the first things he did was to go to the U.S. Embassy to try to renounce his citizenship. And this is a whole other story, which we can go into if you're interested. But anyway, they gave him a little bit of a hard time at first, partly because his father was telexing them saying, don't let him do it. You know, he's upset about the war and, you know, that would be horrible for him to give up his citizenship. But he did go back to the embassy and finally he was able to renounce his citizenship. But the second he stepped out of the embassy in Paris, he was in France illegally. He had no documents. He had to hand in his U.S. passport. So this is this journey of giving up, you might say, the cloak of the nation state that caused him to kill his fellow humans, opened his mind to a whole new world, but a world of statelessness. I like to say that Gary was world full and not stateless, because he really had an appreciation of the world, and not just the world, but the universe, our galactic connections. And he said, I need to do more than just be for myself. I need to be for humanity. I need to do the rest of my life. I need to devote to humanity. And he then tried to travel around the world with no documents. And he kept getting arrested and detained simply for having no document. And this is, of course, a situation for there's about 10 million stateless people in the world, but there's another 65 million people who are either asylum applicants, refugees, or internally or externally displaced. And many of them due to sometimes because of the environment, their home has been destroyed and they don't even have documents themselves. So this is a big problem still today.
And it like happens like overnight.
Exactly. It can easily happen. You know, there's a tsunami or there's a raising of the ocean waters, and then your country could be underwater. You don't have a country anymore. And it can happen, like you said, extremely quickly. So he decided that he needed not only a document to represent him, but he needed government, some kind of government to represent him. Because when you are a citizen, the point of being a citizen of anything is that you have then, hopefully, rights and duties that you can uphold and that will hopefully be respected. And that's why people say that they think citizenship is important, because they want some kind of protection, or they want to live in a community of like-minded people who will also say, do the, you know, like the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And he said, okay, what kind of government would that be that would be, in a sense, universal, that could respect, for example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is an important UN document? What would that government look like? What could it be that would fulfill, in particular, Article 28 that says, of this declaration, that says we have the right to a social and international order in which the rights set forth in the declaration can be fulfilled? So he said, well, it has to be something global. It has to be, you know, maybe not universal yet, because we haven't fully become aware of
consciousness isn't there yet.
Right, yeah. The other beings out there, the consciousness of that. So we have to sort of organize here first, and then when we're better organized, that consciousness will immediately appear to everybody then. But we have to organize it in our brain and our little, you know, dust speck here on Earth first. So that's why he said, okay, So in 1949, he created a Registry of World Citizens, which got, Gary told me this wasn't long before he died in 2013. He said, David, I don't think you knew this, but there were about 7 or 8 million people who sent us postcards and letters right after we created this Registry of World Citizens to support this idea. Now, only about 750,000 people actually registered and got a World Citizen card, but that's still a great number of people. And that was between 1949 and 1950.
You know what, David, that really shows something that none of us were, nothing was revealed in our history books about the intensity of war and how it affected everyone recognizing, is this really what we want? Do I really hate the Germans or the Japanese or the whatever? It must have really been... We only see the one negative side of it, that it really caused a lot of separation amongst countries. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but war causes us to dehumanize another. It makes us think that that person is a quote unquote enemy. Yeah. But what I like to say is, all human beings are biologically the same. We all have the same DNA. I mean, is there something that makes somebody American or Ghanaian or French? No. I mean, yes, there's cultural things, there's linguistics things, there's other classifications that we put on ourselves. But it's that world citizenship status beyond all of that that we can claim, that Gary Davis claimed back in the late 40s, that allows us to, we say, protect those lower level allegiances. Because, for example, when you register with World Service Authority and you receive a World Citizen card in 7 different languages and a World Citizen certificate, that is confirming a legal, official, and political status. But you do not give up any lower level allegiance. You are still a citizen of your locality. Because citizenship, let me ask you this, Alexander. Have you ever been in front of a pond or a still lake and taken a little pebble and thrown it into the water and to see what happens?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Many, many times, and you see the ripple effect.
Exactly. Well, that's citizenship. Citizenship is like concentric circles. You've got the small circle, which I would probably say is your family. Then you're a bigger circle, which might be your city or town. A bigger circle, which might be, you know, the region where you live, the hemisphere, the world, the galaxy, the universe, and if there is such a thing, the multiverse. So we're citizens of all of those all of the time. We may not know it, but we are. And so when you take the idea of world citizenship, it's to say, let us find what's universal, universal principles, natural law, or what we can respect out of, you know, and pinpoint it to some, you know, small list of things like do no harm, make sure no harm is done for anyone else, and keep your word, be good to your word. And that's really the
big... And love the earth.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, of course. Sorry.
And what I mean... I totally agree. And I think that this is a time where we're really needing to break away from countries and continents and more as world citizens, because this is a great step into becoming a galactic human.
Yes. Well,
and we are there. Like, there's so many people that already have a consciousness recognizing that there are other beings that are not of our reality, okay, that really want to work with us, and we need to grow up and step up.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, I feel like we're, Jean-Paul Sartre used to say, and I speak French, he said, nous sommes des sous-hommes à la recherche de notre humanité, meaning we are subhumans searching for our humanity. And I really think that that is true. I mean, we haven't really become fully human yet, because we haven't completely understood that if we obliterate the earth, like you said, the environment, we have to do no harm to it, but we obliterate ourselves. So it's an understanding that I know you have and all the people who listen to you and watch your shows have. We just need to expand this dramatically. Absolutely. Exponentially.
And that's what I'm asking my audience right now. I'm really asking everyone to step up. This is a very insignificant amount of money to make a statement, if nothing else, to the world. Can you imagine what would happen if all of us that are listening to this radio show stepped up and not only registered as world citizens, but purchased your passports okay, which they issue these passports, I understand, but the prices are very reasonable. Can you go over that just very quickly? Right.
So here's what the cover of the World Passport looks like. There's also, you can take a look at that on our website, but it is a very minimal cost for the issuance services that we provide. We offer actually four validity period passports, passport valid for 3 years, that's $55, yeah. 5 years. $75, and the 10-year is $100, which is pretty comparable to most governments' passports around the world. And then we have a special, what we call our World Donor Passport. That's for a person who wants to make a donation to our refugee fund of $400 or more. It could be $4,000. It doesn't matter. Whatever, any amount of $400 or more will allow us to issue that individual, in a sense, you might say it's a thank you document, but it's just as valid or legitimate as any of the others that we issue, valid for 15 years. And that allows the World Service Authority to provide free legal advocacy by legal letter writing campaigns and legal briefs to refugees who are in refugee camps. And we also try to provide every year a percentage of all the documents we issue for free to refugees, especially those in camps.
That's phenomenal. Now, I read about just one of your many documents, but the one that was so intriguing was about Nigeria.
Agonia refugees.
Can you talk to them a little bit about that? I mean, we all read about the massive impact that has occurred within the Middle Eastern countries, Syria, the massive refugee crisis, literally, that's going on. I have friends in France that have written me emails. I had no idea. People in England, Sweden, that are writing me emails where there is so much happening within their own cities and towns, like all-time high crime rate skyrocketing, a lot of prejudice, a lot of bullying, just a lot of stuff like that. Tell me a little bit about this particular really success story. I want people to hear about how we can help all these refugees that have been derailed, literally, out of their homes and their cities, towns, villages.
Sure. Well, there's one particular group of people who got a hold of us. It's already been about 10 years, believe it or not, that we've been working with these people. There's a group of people called the Agonis who had their tribal land was in Nigeria. But Shell Oil Company had an agreement with the government of Nigeria to do digging for oil. And unfortunately, it just so happened that the homeland of the Ogoni people was where most of the oil was. And they did the kind of digging that they did really destroyed the land. It destroyed its fertility. They couldn't grow crops. It also meant that they were displaced from many of them from their homes. They had to leave because they were forced to by the government and by the oil company rigs coming in to dig for the oil. So many of these people left under sometimes very sad and scary situation of threat of even death. And thousands of them, at least 10 to 20,000 of them, fled to Benin, the neighboring country. But most of them have been sort of languishing in refugee camps in Benin because the Benin government says, well, these people weren't born here. What do I care? The idea of being their brother or their sibling's keeper didn't come into play, and that's sadly true for most national governments when people from another place where they weren't born there come in. So they fled there en masse, and it means that they can't work. Can they get a minimum amount of schooling? Perhaps. I mean, certainly they at least have some basic shelter and food every day. Well, so we heard about this situation. We had even heard that the African Court on Human and People's Rights had agreed with a case that the Ogoni people had taken all the way up to the African Court, which is the highest court for all of the countries of Africa, even beyond the Nigerian or Benin courts. And they agreed with the Ogonis that, yes, they've been treated improperly. They should be able to go back to Nigeria. All their land should be repaired so that they can actually live peacefully the rest of their lives there. But nothing has happened. And we can see even further in Nigeria, it's very sad because you've heard about Boko Haram and their treatment of especially women and girls and harsh, violent behavior towards other human beings. And so it's not just, the government with a company, it's even
all over the place,
even factions of people, trying to take power within the country. So yes, you hear about Syria, you hear about Iraq or Afghanistan, but you don't hear so much about Nigeria. And we really should hear much more about this. Well, so World Service Authority got involved first to say, look, we want to issue as many of these refugees passports because this could help them to get out of the refugee camp and either find work in Benin or go to a completely different country. And so we issued, over about a three-year period, I guess we issued between 1 and 2,000 world passports, which is still, that's nothing. I mean, that's a small drop in the bucket, but we financially are a small organization. We don't have enough funding for the kind of important work that we know needs to be done. I mean, part of our, I think our issue is that we're revolutionary.
Yeah.
We're trying to change the world.
And we relate to you.
You know, it's when you see, here living in America, everything's commercialized. You turn on the TV and you see a commercial for dogs and cats who have been abused, or you may say a commercial of a child with a distended stomach, you know, with flies on them and stuff. And you're like, oh my God, I've got to give, a dollar a day to help that child, or I got to give my $25 to, stop pets from being abused, or dogs and cats from being abused. So, but the idea of world peace, it's kind of amorphous. Where is that? I mean, I'm looking up here in the room to say, well, where is world peace? So to get people to understand, which I think, Alexander, what you're doing today for this idea of world citizenship and galactic citizenship is crucial, because people need to know about it. Not enough people know about it. And if we had more people who are aware, whether they're funding our services or not, the more people who become aware of this, the more powerful the idea becomes, obviously. So I think it's easier.
Well, and also, David, the consciousness.
Yes.
See, it just takes one person, just one person to start this.
Yes.
To create a literal filament of energy wave. Yes. And once that begins, others will follow without even understanding why. And this is why it's so imperative for those of us that are listening to this interview. My audience is awesome. I constantly say this. They're some of the most enlightened beings on the planet, and they get it. They get it. And so I just felt so strongly, now you actually funded the issuance fees yourself. WSA right. did for right. this particular thing.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so how did that affect them once they got these?
Sure, that's the next step of the story, I guess you might say. Many of them were able to use it to get out to neighboring countries. Some, though, sadly, we reported back that they made, and I won't name countries. I guess it's not maybe it wouldn't be polite perhaps to do so, but they made it to other countries. And found, sadly, that once they got there, it was actually worse than being in the refugee camp. Because even those other completely separate countries other than Benin didn't want those people there. They weren't going to help them find work. They weren't going to help them find clothing, food, shelter, basic needs. And they actually said, we're actually thinking of going back to the refugee camp, because at least there we had some kind of community. We had our friends and relatives. We didn't have much of a life, but at least we had something. So in a sense, they were completely on their own when they made it to other countries. And that was really sad to me to hear that. So once again, the World Passport, it is a tool that can open doors to people. It's like a stepping stone or springboard. For many people, it may be a quick fix and the only solution to their problem. For other people, it may be a medium step. I mean, a quick story. There were some Afghan and Iraq refugees who had made it to Norway. And they had heard about the World Service Authority and said, look, we have nothing. We have no documents. All our documents were lost in our flight, when they were fleeing from those countries to make it to Norway. And they said, we need something. So they got the World Passport. Now, what the World Passport did for them is it gave them a document that they could show to their bank so that they could open a bank account. Then they were able to get a bank ID card which had their photograph on it, and that bank ID card was then the next step that allowed them to leave Norway to go to Sweden, Denmark, and Finland to actually find work if they couldn't find it in Norway. So in a sense, it was almost like a medium step. I mean, we're always saying that the World Passport is really, it's a passport to end all passports. Mm-hmm. Because you know that as human beings, we have rights. We are born with rights. They are innate. Those rights are unalienable. We cannot give them up. And because we have those rights, we should be able to claim them. We should be able to exercise them. So by providing them with this passport, we're saying, well, or anyone with a passport, we as human beings, our passport is our body. People sometimes ask me, where do you live? And I say, in my body. or they say, where are you from? And I say, planet Earth. And they always laugh. They're like, no, but where really where you were born? And I said, well, I was expelled from my mother's womb into the earth, onto the earth.
It's very true. And going back to what you said, Article 15, we have the inalienable right to travel freely without being tied to country's origin or loyalties.
Yes.
That's like one of the core reasons that this began. So going back to Gary, mm-hmm. okay, and you touched a little bit upon that, he really had to go through a lot of imprisonment and harassment, et cetera, to develop the whole WSA philosophy and create this, did he not?
Oh yeah, he was in 34 prisons, and because it wasn't because he presented the passport, it was because he was presenting an idea that challenged their thought of what the world is or was or who was in power. Because Gary Davis was a renunciate. He could go to a border and the border official would say, I don't accept that passport. And Gary would say, well, I do. So what does a border official say to what will I do? It sort of stumped them. And it was always, Gary in a sense was the ultimate salesperson, because he wanted to open a conversation with everyone he spoke with about human rights, about freedom of movement, freedom of ideas, freedom of expression. And when he was stopped at the border, he would say, well, show me the law against this. If you can't show me a law, and there never is a law, there has never been a law against the world passport. There might be some foreign affairs manuals, which are not law, that mention it as a document that they don't want to recognize, but it's not a law. And he would say, whatever's not prohibited by law is allowed by law. So certainly Gary Davis faced in his life big hurdles. We still face hurdles every day because, and I love to quote Schopenhauer, the German philosopher, who said, truth passes through three phases. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. Third, it's accepted as self-evident.
That's what we're going through right now.
Exactly. That's what we're going through right now. The idea of our galactic connection, the idea of to the universe, to the other existence and beings out there. Our understanding of who we are as human beings is being questioned by the system that currently exists and is trying to hang on tooth and nail to its power. So we're going through ridicule and violent opposition of the idea of a world citizenship situation of us living in that kind of community where we see the world as one, where you can travel wherever you want to on planet Earth and no one stops you unless you're harming somebody. A world where everyone has their human rights met and needs met. I mean, that would be a wonderful world, but it has to start somewhere. So World Service Authority, I mean, Gary Davis, he lived up till he was almost 92, but it was about 65 to 70 years of his adult life that he was working on this idea of world citizenship. You could say just planting the seeds of world citizenship. And your conversation, your mention earlier, I mean, a lot of people are suffering through as activists to get their thought process out to the world, this consciousness raising awareness. I mean, look at, you know, Rosa Parks, what she suffered through, or Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King. I mean, people in the Black Lives Matter movement have been suffering, young black men being shot on the street. I mean, people are suffering in the here and now, and that's just over here. What about the people being shot in their home in Aleppo for no other reason than simply happening to be in that spot at this time? Right. So there's a lot of people, it wasn't just Gary Davis suffering, there's a lot of suffering going on in this world, and we think that the idea of world citizenship and having global governmental institutions like a World Court of Human Rights can help us as human beings come together to make a world that works for everyone, to alleviate the suffering. And one other thing that comes to mind, which you said, even one person can have the strength of mind or consciousness and share that with a multitude. And have you ever heard of the book, The 100th Monkey by Ken Keyes Jr.?
Absolutely.
Yeah, of course. Well, so, I mean, maybe your followers know this, but I would really encourage people to find a copy. It's probably not in print anymore, but to find a copy in the local library of The 100th Monkey by Ken Keyes, because it talks about how we like to say, well, who's that 100th world citizen or that 100 millionth world citizen, that person who's going to sort of
scale.
The scale, right. Who's going to raise that scale to such a level that all of a sudden everybody realizes, okay, you know, right before that Schopenhauer point, viewpoint, it was right here before our nose, that is, it becomes self-evident that, yeah, we really are world citizens. We just haven't created the institutions to be fully functioning yet that allow us to live that way.
I totally agree. I got to add this too. It's coming in. Every single human on Earth have been displaced from somewhere else.
True.
We are not from, we're, our origins are not here. We actually, that's a whole nother story. But this should be touching each of us in our heart, because displacement is what this is all about.
Yes.
There are so many people displaced in this world. And even those that are like yourself or myself, those of us that really have a passion and a vision to bring forth a world of peace, harmony, love, and acceptance of whatever you are. Okay, as long as it's not damaging Earth, hurting another human being, or corrupting something.
Right.
This is where we should be. But the displacement alone is probably the number one thing that every star seed should feel about this. And that's probably what drew me to your information, is that you're assisting those people. And we're on kind of like the at the bottom of the ladder, you know, density-wise and physically. And so it's even more distorted where we are here. But it starts at the top. And if we can meet in some way to stop this displacement, it will have a massive impact on what you were talking about, the 100th monkey. Have a massive impact.
Yeah. I love speaking to people who I've never really had an in-depth conversation with before, because I am always learning. I think it's so important and it's so exciting that we as human beings have a curiosity and have learning. This gives me an idea for another blog, maybe about, sure. I've written about displacement, but I love, Alexandra, your idea that we're really all displaced. I've thought about that, but never in the way you've put it. And I love to quote Carl Sagan, who said, "We are all star stuff," is how he used to say. And so we've come from somewhere else. And
so maybe many other areas.
Part of our problem with the violence on the planet and just the ease that we move towards hate instead of love, maybe is because we feel in our core displaced, like we're not really necessarily where we should be. This is so interesting to me.
And on top of that, there is a bit of rage within, there's an anger within the mass consciousness, as well as possibly within each of us, where what we actually were divinely created to be has been stripped of us. Okay. So now we have the opportunity to really show our stuff, because we've had a lot of support from galactic intervention. We've had a tremendous amount of changes going on in the planet that are literally, for the first time in our lives, we're really starting to see some things start lightening up. Okay. As much as there's distortion, I'm acknowledging that, trust me.
Sure.
There's also, if you really look for it, which I always do, you're going to see some amazing miracles popping up everywhere that are showing that the consciousness is rising. And we're talking political leaders and world leaders, like maybe within the universities, etc., that are starting to notice that, wow, if I don't get on this bandwagon of recognizing that we're working as a world citizenry, and guess what's been the most number one tool that's caused that? The World Wide Web.
Yes.
Thank God for the World Wide Web.
Oh, wholeheartedly.
Which the plan really wasn't supposed to go there, okay, by the government. It really wasn't.
No, I know. They wanted it for their military purposes.
Exactly. Yeah. But look at how awesome the light is. They always take the lemons and make lemonade. Always.
Yes.
They're always going to outnumber and overpower the darkness. And that's where we're at. We're on the other side of this tipping scale. I just want to keep reminding people, because things are really, really intense and distorted right now.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Back to what you were saying.
Thought really quick before you asked the next maybe question or idea. I've been here for 25 years. And I have to tell you, some days I come in and I feel a little dejected. I feel like, what have I spent 25 years of my life? What did Gary Davis spend almost 70 years of his adult life doing this when it's all getting like sort of thrown back at us? But then, you know, that's just a momentary, you know, either not enough sleep, you know what I mean? I didn't have something to eat that day or something that is affecting just my mind. But then, of course, as soon as I nourish a little bit my body where I, which I have to, then my mind reawakens and says, oh my God, David, if you had to give this up and you had to do something else, that would be the sad thing. So I feel like you just said, Alexander, that we're shedding light, both on the consciousness side of making people aware of the kind of beautiful, safe, environmentally sound and sustainable world that we can have, as well as the kind of people, humans, that we can be.
You know, this, we really, actually, David, we are.
We are that.
We've just forgotten who we are. I love that comment. We really have. And why is that? Because we've been implanted, we've been overlaid, we've been chipped, we've been tortured, we've been experimented on, we've been cast down into lower dimensional frequencies without our permission and our approval. There are a lot of things that we have been subjugated to experience. But the fact of the matter is, we've gotten through that. That's why there's so much attention here, is just watching, what are we going to do next? This is the big moment where the curtain comes up, and now everything we've wanted, and you're such a big piece of that, now we can really move forward. We are finally really, there's so much of a path cleared for us now to be able to create this world governance that you were talking about. I was going to talk to you about that a little bit. Sure. But I do want to give Gary full coverage, because his ideas are phenomenal. And the fact that he had such the staying power all the way up till, what, 93, yeah, to continue this vision of making sure that there were no boundaries, that we were all of the same world. That was his premise, you know, to really. Now, one of the questions when I was reading through all the documentation, you said 700 cities have declared themselves. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, over 700 communities, cities, even states have declared themselves as world cities or world states. Really, what it is a, it's much more on a symbolic level at this point. It's similar to, if you've heard of like the sister city program, that idea where the city says, well, we're a world city. They make a declaration about why they're a world city, why they see themselves, like the state of Minnesota has, and I think the city of Minneapolis has, for example, said, well, we're a world city. We see ourselves linked to the rest of the world, not just America, but all parts of the world. We have people from all over the world who live here in our city, and we want to know that everyone to know that we welcome everyone, and we want everyone to welcome us. So it's really a declaration of that sort of welcoming feeling or viewpoint of themselves. And that's about as far as it goes so right now. And that program or process is called Mundialization. And we're not the only ones who've worked on that process. There's other outside or separate organizations that have worked on Mundialization. I mean, what we're doing, you might say, is to Mundialize the individual on an individual person-by-person basis when they register as a world citizen and confirm that status in addition to whatever other status they might claim or have.
Well, let's face it. I mean, a city is just an amalgamation of a bunch of people.
Yes.
You know? Exactly. So yeah. Where does it all begin? It begins within us to make the decision that we are part of this bigger soup. And we've been designed lately, you know, over the course of hundreds of years especially, we've been designed to become more and more and more reclusive, more and more alone and separate and solitary. And this is something that's so near and dear to every starseed's heart, in my opinion, is to really be able to reconnect with all of those that are their true family members.
Yes.
And I just feel like this is so, so key. Now, question, going back to Gary. So World War II bomber pilot, he was apparently on Broadway. I mean, this guy was just amazing. Gets out of the war, gets thrown in prison 34 times because he's so like passionate about getting this done. And then he finally does. Can you share the story about the United Nations where they all got up and, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know exactly.
Awesome. Yeah. story.
Yes, it really is. And Gary really became world famous back in, you know, between 48 and 50. He was on the newsreels that were shown at movie theaters. He was on the cover of Life magazine and other, you know, world press because of, the one thing that he did, one of the first things he did was to camp out at the Palais de Chaillot, which is the U-shaped building across from the Eiffel Tower that was the house of UN General Assembly when the UN building in New York had not been built yet, you know, on the Hudson River. That hadn't been built yet. So there for a while, they were housing the UN in Paris. So this was right not long after Gary had renounced his U.S. citizenship, handed in his U.S. passport. He was, like I said, he was really in France illegally. But the UN said, we are going to declare the area of the Palais de Chaillot and the surrounding land as international territory. And Gary said, well, where better for a world citizen to go than to live on world territory? So he got a little sleeping bag, a little cushion to sleep on. And his biggest concern was, okay, if I'm sleeping out here on the steps of the Palais de Chaillot, where do I go to the bathroom? That was his biggest concern. So he's like, okay, where do I find steps near the commissaries? So there was a commissary which he could come in and out of the door without a problem, where he could eat his, you know, lunch or dinner or whatever. And there was a bathroom in there. But then he could go right back out on the steps because they wouldn't let him sleep in the building. And the point was not for him to be really protected. It was the point for people to see him and question him why, because he was an actor. So he was always acting on this world stage, and he wanted people to come up to him and ask him, what are you doing there on the, you know, camping out on the steps of the UN building? And he would explain. And more media and press and expatriate Americans like Richard Wright were coming up to him saying, I want to join this movement of world citizenship, because they saw this one little guy who got all this media. And in fact, it was overshadowing what the UN was doing inside. And so he was there for 6 full nights, 7 days. But on the 7th day, the UN didn't like the fact that he was getting more media than they were. And they basically called the French police in. They dragged him and his little tent that the French had given him out of international territory and back into France. And this was, you know, very frustrating to him. And of course, but this really made him world famous. And then, of course, people were always hanging on what was the next thing that Gary Davis was going to do and what was he going to say. And one of the things they did, which you referred to momentarily ago, was he, Gary, and about 20 other people hid in the public gallery section of the UN General Assembly meeting and called for a world parliament, called for world peace, and said, you know, I stand here before you in the name of humanity, and if you won't bring us together and create a, you know, situation of world peace among all the people of the world, then move aside and we will. Gary didn't even really get to finish his whole speech because immediately this was inside the gallery of the UN and the Palais. They pulled him out. The UN police pulled him out and took him away. But fortunately, that's why they had all of these other people in the gallery who were continuing the speech in front of everybody. And if this was filmed, and you can, I know it's in, there's a man named Arthur Canegas who's just completed a documentary on Gary Davis called The World Is My Country, The True Story of Gary Davis. And it's a wonderful documentary. It's about an hour and a half long. It has not yet premiered globally, but we're expecting it to do so hopefully within the next few months.
Let me know.
I will. There have been some sneak previews. In fact, just for Human Rights Day last week, we in Burlington, Vermont, which was where Gary lived for the last about 20 years of his life, we did put on a sneak preview presentation of the documentary at the Peace and Justice Center there. But anyway, so this was one event that was really amazing for the world to see, that even one or just a few people could interrupt the UN, the squabbling of nations, to say, look, if you're not going to do it, move, you know, step aside. So other things happened because of that. Like
that's the part I wanted you to share also.
Well,
the real biggie of what he accomplished by being snuck, kind of smuggled into the United Nations meetings.
Well, so there's a couple things. One, and this may be not the one you're referring to, and I'll get to the one you're referring to in a moment, but Eleanor Roosevelt had a column called My Day, both on the radio and written. And she understood what Gary Davis was doing. She was one of the co-creators of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So she understood the idea of moving beyond just the nation state to have a not just a united nation, so to speak, but a united world. The world is already united, so you don't even need the word united in front of it. But so she wrote in her column, look, if you know the UN was founded, and in fact, even Herbert Evett, the first UN Secretary General, said, wrote in a letter to Gary that the UN wasn't created to make peace. It was created to maintain peace once the nations were at peace. But when have the nations ever been at peace? Pretty much never, right? So in Eleanor Roosevelt, in her column, wrote, look, you know, Gary Davis, if we can't do it, then he should here and now step up and create his own worldwide government of, by, and for the people of the world. And so that was a really important impetus, but that's not really, in my mind, I think one of the biggest stories was the fact that this Universal Declaration of Human Rights back in December of 1948, no one knew for sure whether it would even come into existence. It was written over several years. It had international lawyers and jurists and even governments behind it, but it really depended upon a vote of the UN members present at that time. And when it was brought up in the travaux préparatoires, the preparatory meetings and all, the preparatory work to create it, there was always the threat that certain governments might reject it. You know, might veto it, actually. And so Gary knew about this. Gary knew what was going on. And because he had garnered the media attention, he decided, well, let's have a big meeting. And he had a big meeting at a sports venue called the Vélodrome d'Hiver, which doesn't exist anymore. It was a big sports arena in Paris. And about 20,000 war-weary Europeans showed up, believe it or not. Not just French, but German, Italian, Spaniards, Portuguese, all from Brits, all came to hear Gary Davis speak. And his whole point of this meeting was that we need to come together as one human family to understand who we are, and not just because, kumbaya, we love each other, but because people are suffering. People are dying needlessly because governments think that they don't have to help people, the other, the people who are outside their so-called borders. We have to help each other. And this was right before the UN was voting on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And for me, this isn't the story you're thinking, but for me, this was the most important thing that, one of the most important things that Gary did early on in his career as a world citizen, you might say. And that is, after this meeting, the next day, instead of voting against the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because they saw that the tide was going towards respect for human rights, certain governments like Russia, instead of voting against it, they simply abstained, which allowed a unanimous acceptance of all the countries who voted to support the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it went through. So I really think if Gary Davis hadn't had that meeting of 20,000 people, it could be quite possible now that we wouldn't even have a fundamental statement of our innate and inalienable rights. I mean, the Declaration isn't the be-all and end-all of all of our rights, because we determine what our rights are, sure. And there's some great constitutions like the U.S. one in the Ninth Amendment that affirms that. It says the enumeration of certain rights in the Constitution shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people. That is, we the people determine what our rights are. I feel like, as a human rights lawyer, I feel like we're almost like discoverers. On the seas of understanding, we set up our sail, we see the rights come towards us and we learn about them as we advance. Like you said, I think the light is coming in more and more and advancing our brain power, and we can see, this is a right. I didn't realize this was a right before, but it is, and so let's respect it now, and let's respect it universally. So once again, I think Gary's, if I had to put Gary's legacy in just a few words, it would really be a universal understanding that we have universal rights that should be universally respected. And it's up to us to do that.
That's so perfect. And you mentioned that the Russians abstained. What the audience may not know is that they continued to vote against this, right? Over and over and over. They continued to block this, the right. Universal Human Rights Declaration.
Can I step in real quick?
Sure.
I don't know who your listeners are, but I want your listeners to know, it doesn't matter where people are born or what the government is. I'm not here to like defame any one government. I might be here to defame all national governments, to say that's that national system that's a problem. Because what the Russian government might defame or be against one day, they might then the next day be supporting the American government.
That's exactly what's going on now, David. And I don't even know if you know about this, but the government, and we are aware of who's behind it, put out kind of a witch hunt list of 200 websites, which Galactic Connection is on. Wow. And and this just happened on the 30th of November, I think, is when it started. Uh-huh. And they put this list out basically trying to insinuate that because we put out alternative news and so much of it is the truth,
right,
that is countering the lamestream media. They've already put out video after video showing from one news station to the next that they almost say the exact same thing, folks. So, you know, those 200 websites, we have really paid our dues and put a lot of information out that's very controversial. We've experienced like after effects because of it. Anyway, because of that, they're actually trying to point fingers at it. It's almost like the days of McCarthy, where they're trying to insinuate that we're spies for the Russian government. Okay. And the reason I bring this up is because Russia, in many, many ways, along with China, have single-handedly affected the tipping scale on the planet politically to assist the United States of America. Okay, so sure. I agree with you. I'm not all about like, oh, Russia's this and that. No way. I mean, everything changes, and it used to be a chessboard. Now there's some really major changes going on.
Right.
And don't forget, there's major galactic beings that assist all the various governments. Okay, so we're way beyond this planetary level now.
Right.
So no, I'm in total agreement with you. So tell me about. Apparently, Gary saw like this just huge refugee issue from World War One, right?
Yes.
And didn't that impact a lot of what he ended up putting together? Again, look at what we're talking about, a displaced group, massive group of people who didn't even see it coming, didn't know it was coming. You have no idea when a tsunami comes or when a civil war comes through their village or what have you. And the next thing you know, your wife, children, grandparents, whatever, are running for their lives. And this, would you say that this is happening a lot right now on the planet?
Oh, of course. I mean, if you look at percentage wise, it doesn't seem like that much. It's about a 1% of the world's population who are, at least that the media reports, 1% of the world's population is left. That's like I said, about 75 million people are internally, externally displaced or refugees or stateless. But there's a lot of people, which you can't, I don't even think we can quantify, who are living in, if not outright oppressive situations or regimes, are living in some, you know, sort of hidden oppression or repression. And that's, I don't even know how quantifiable that is, because that happens everywhere. That happens in our own backyard, where there's abuse, whether it's a family abuse or whether it's a street crime and poverty that's causing people to get into behaviors that are, you know, really anti-human or antithetical to existence. So certainly, I'm sure it's a lot more than 1% of people who are suffering from some kind of what you could call, in a larger sense, a displacement from respect of their rights. But to go back to your thought about the World War One, there was an individual who a lot of your followers may know, named Friedhof Nansen. And he, between World War One and World War Two, he had created the Nansen Passport Office and created a passport for the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who were also stranded because of the change, as you know, that occurs in these fictional borders that governments create to either maintain their power or they lose their power. So things change, and people might lose their quote unquote citizenship or nationality overnight. So His office won the Nobel Peace Prize for the creating this password and helping hundreds of thousands of people to find a safe haven in other parts of the world. And there was this was a few years ago, but there's something called the World Policy Journal that put out an article about identity and travel and mentioned the Nansen password and actually said that the World Service Authority World Passport is the successor to the Nansen passport. And certainly Gary Davis said that too. Gary would say, look, we're just taking up the mantle of what Nansen did in his passport office and providing these documents to every human being who wants to get it or who can get it, and helping them to find a place in the world where they can safely exercise their rights and maybe reestablish a new home if they have to. So certainly, excuse me, this displacement is dear to the heart of what World Service Authority is trying to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And let me just take a real quick sip of water. I'm sorry.
No problem.
What I was going to say is one of our current really exciting projects is our World Citizenship Identity Project is what I would describe it as. And that is to have world citizenship be considered a valid additional citizenship to any other citizenship or nationality that someone may have or potentially doesn't have. And what that would mean is, because once again, citizenship is linked to our rights and duties. If we have that status, I mean, everyone has rights and duties, whether you have a citizenship, a nationality, excuse me, or not.
But it's about having the documentation.
Well, having the documentation. I mean, once again, our body should be our document. If someone sees you, when you get off a plane,
we're just not there yet.
Well, we're not there yet. I mean, what I like to say, it's a bridge to that. I mean, when you get off a plane, they know you're not a grizzly bear. They know you're not a shark. They know you're a human being and you have rights and they should be respected. So that doesn't mean that they don't take your fingerprint or a scan of your retina, maybe. But just because you're poor means you shouldn't be able to go to some other place in the world? No. So, I mean, we need to make every place in the world wealthy, and we have enough resources to do that, certainly. And that's a whole other topic we can get to in a little while. But so the idea of getting to the heart of displacement in multiple levels, this World Citizenship ID or Identity Project can provide people, whoever they are, with documentation that they can say, yes, I'm a world citizen. So yes, I had to leave my, a country because, you know, it was overrun by a marauding army, or I had to leave my country because, the heat destroyed all the crops and I'll die if I can't find food. Well, that person, when they arrive in that next place, should be welcomed. They shouldn't be, chastised for leaving or locked up in, camps or whatever. They should be welcomed. And there's plenty of resources on our planet if we use them wisely and sustainably and for, as Buckminster Fuller would say, for livingry instead of weaponry.
I love that. I heard that from you before.
Okay.
It seems to me that the more of us that get this and show it, reveal it, and use it in our daily lives, whether we're flying on and off planes or whatever, just literally bringing this out to show people, hey, I'm a world citizen. And it'll be enough for people to ask questions. And those that are asleep will actually be triggered. That's just my feeling. Now, how do people subscribe to the World Citizens Group?
Sure. Well, so we have, I think, nine different social media platforms. Our main, of course, platform, which is a little bit outdated, and we're working, I hope, to have some money to be able to fix this, but is our website, which you already mentioned, worldservice.org. That's one, worldservice is one word in singular, .org. And from there, though, you can link to our Facebook page, which is simply facebook.com/worldserviceauthority. Our Twitter feed is @worldcitizengov. So worldcitizengov is our Twitter handle. We have a YouTube channel where I love what you do. And at some point, I would love to have even more time to also conduct interviews and meet with interesting, amazing other humans and talk to them about how their work relates to what we're trying to do here, which I've done a little bit. We've had some guests talking about travel or identity on our YouTube channel, which you can see, which is, I think, YouTube/user/World Service Official. But once again, there's links to all that at worldservice.org. two, if you want, you can download application forms for the World Passport, for the World ID card. If you're a refugee, we have a World Political Asylum card. If you want to affirm your right to be married, for the anybody in the straight or the LGBTQ community, anyone can get a World Marriage Certificate. We've been doing that since I've been here, way before it became like legal in the United States for any couple to be considered married. We have a World Media Association press pass. That's for people in the professional media like yourself. We have of course, registering as a world citizen, a world birth card and birth certificate. Just a quick example. There was a child born in Russia, but of ethnically non-Russian parents. And he had nothing, and the state of would not issue him a birth certificate because he wasn't, you know, really considered a national of their country, because his parents weren't. So they were desperately looking for something. They heard about us. They got him a World Birth Certificate, and the World Birth Certificate helped at least initially so that he could go to see a doctor, because the doctor wasn't, if he didn't have like a birth certificate, the doctor wasn't even going to see him, because they couldn't really, who is he? You know, they didn't have any ID. Yeah. Like the piece of paper is more important than the child there in front of you. That's kind of ridiculous. Anyway, but then what we did is we got an apostille, which is a certified documentation by the Secretary of the State to say that this, you know, that I, a statement that I made as president of the organization that affirmed its validity based on Article 1 of the Declaration of Human Rights and other treaties.
Right on.
And then with that apostille, because an apostille confirms that in countries that are party to the Hague Convention on apostilles, that means that those other countries have to accept that certification or notarization. So they brought that apostille along with the birth certificate, and then the child was able to go to school. In fact, just this week, and it's waiting in our processing, one of our processing rooms, is his father's document, who hadn't gotten this before, but his father's getting a passport, and now the child, and this was must have been a while ago, because the child, I was surprised, he's like 16 now, or 17, so he's grown up and been having these documents, and now they're renewing, which is great. So what I was going to say is, from our website, you can download the application forms, but if it's hard to find or if it's not making sense, simply email us to info@worldservice.org, and we will be glad to send you, it's a 3 or 4 page explanation of the, you might say, the philosophy and the symbolism, as well as the practical nature of the passport. It will provide the fees for all the different options of the documents that you might get. It will provide shipping fees, and it will also provide fees for expedited service. Just like many institutions, because we're small, we do charge an expedite fee to get things done very quickly. If you're willing to wait the normal 2.5 months processing time, then there's no expedite fee. But that may be too long to wait for some people.
I want you to know I'm going to be ordering mine soon.
Woo! Yes, all right.
So, and I'm going to order the World Media.
Okay.
One, excellent. And definitely the of course the passport. And I think the question that's rolling around in a lot of people's heads is how much meat does that hold versus the existing passport? I know you've already stated that you do not get rid of the other passport. Yeah. This is used in addition to it, but people are probably wondering, well, how much meat does that have? That's my first question. And my second question is, I want to talk to you about the universal court.
Right.
And we got to get into that.
Okay. Sure. Well, so let's get to the meat of the meat.
Yeah.
So what you're asking about, the meat of the validity, really, the legal recognition and authority of this world passport is really that question. And one, I would first say that not everybody is as fortunate as we might be to even have both a national document or a passport, any kind of document, even just for some people, as well as having this as an option or an alternative. So there's many people where this is their only document. Like Gary Davis, once he renounced his citizenship and didn't ever want to get it back, he could never get a national document, and he wasn't going to get a citizenship of another country. No, he wanted to remain a world citizen his entire life. So this was all he could use. He had to make it work. So what Gary would, a couple ways to approach this question is, Gary would say, look, this document doesn't work. You work it. I mean, what does this do? This, I just dropped it. It's sitting on the table below me here, right? It doesn't do anything on its own. You do the doing. You have to make it work. And unfortunately, the system that you have to make this work in, which is this nation state system, is not always fair. It's not always just. It's not all, equality is never always, you know, at the top priority of government officials. Fear and division, unfortunately, is, and maybe money and power, are at the top of the list of things that government and national government or even border officials want to make sure is respected, not so much the equality and the rights, unfortunately. So using this document, I have to say you become a human rights educator, a human rights activist. You do have to, and I have a long list of what I call the 10 P's of passport usage. I won't go into that. You can find we have a YouTube video about that. But you have to be peaceful, polite, professional, sure, persuasive, persistent, patient, basically, and have perseverance when you're using this document, because unlike the national passport, like the U.S. passport or Canadian passport, as just two quick examples, in many countries in the world, there's visa waiver program where you just show up, say, in England, you know, at Heathrow Airport, and you show your U.S. or Canadian passport, and they'll say, oh, okay, sure, 6 months visa stamp, no employment allowed, you know, so you're there as a tourist, for example, but you get 6 months, and then you do have to leave, otherwise you're violating their law and they can arrest you. But anyway, so there are about 40, 45 countries, at least with the United States, that have a visa waiver program. But there are countries, and a lot of Americans don't know this, that don't have a visa waiver program with the United States, meaning that just because you're, you know, I'm this proud American and I can go where I want, you know, whatever, that's not necessarily the case. Because, wait, hold on, I've got to cancel this call. It's coming in on Skype, sorry.
Okay.
Sorry, modern technology of communication. So the using the world passport, I mean the U.S. passport to go to, say, Brazil or India, you actually need a visa ahead of time. You have to go to the consulate and apply, or you can't just show up at the airport. Now, so with the world passport, and I guess I'll get to the meat of the matter here, you do generally need to apply for a visa prior to travel. And that will help, because we always tell the strategy I like to tell people, the legal strategy you might say, is first go to a consulate of a country that you don't necessarily intend to go to, or you might go to their consulate and apply for a visa. It doesn't matter what country it is. It could be Dominican Republic. It could be Togo. It could be Guatemala. It could be wherever. Gambia. It doesn't matter. You pick a country and you say, okay, I'm going to try to go to their consulate and get a visa. Once you have a stamp, even one, in your world passport, of course, it's easier to get other visas. Without a stamp, of course, it is a little bit hard, because there's visa pages in the passport that are blank until you get stamps put in it. So that's hard. And now, I guess, let me put it to a bottom line here about the, you might say, the legality, authenticity, and recognition of the passport. So there are different, I guess you might say, recognition levels of this. So the first recognition is by states. There have been over 185 countries that have recognized the world passport on a case-by-case basis, meaning on individual cases, by placing visa entry and exit stamps in it. That's almost 95% of all the countries in the world have recognized it.
Wow.
And then there are six countries, which is a small number though, that have officially recognized it, which means they should, in most circumstances, recognize it. Then there's been recognition by the, you know, at this point, close to a million people who have been issued world passports since 1954. So there's the state recognition, there's individual recognition. Then there's also recognition under some important treaties, like the UN Charter. Articles 55 and 56 affirm that all governments shall jointly and separately respect our fundamental human rights. There's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 12, affirming the right to freedom of movement. Article 13 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, affirming the right to freedom of movement. And then there are regional treaties, like the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, the American Convention, the European Convention, the Arab Charter on Rights, etc., that also affirm the rights to freedom of movement, freedom of residence. There are over 100 national constitutions, which is about half the countries in the world, that actually mention certain rights, like the right to freedom of movement or residence, even within their national constitutions. So the framework from like high on like, you know, might say jus cogens, which is a peremptory norm of international law, even all the way down to national constitutions affirm the validity of the basis for the world passport, that is the right to freedom of travel. And then I would say customary international law, which is not specifically binding on countries, But they have agreed, and in many circumstances do respect it, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other declarations like the American Declaration on Rights. This affirms the validity of the passport. And then, I guess, if all else fails, if a government is set against violating a treaty, violating customary international law, even maybe violating its own national constitution, we go back to those innate and unalienable rights that we have simply by being universal beings. That so wherever we are in the universe, or multiverse, or multiversal beings, we have rights and duties too, but rights that should be respected and that we should respect of others. And we say that this world passport is based upon that innate and unalienable right to travel freely on our own planet. No one should be able to tell you that you can't go where you want to or live and work where you want to on your own planet. But governments do. They do on a day-to-day basis because governments, and I guess the bottom line here is governments, because they are exclusive and human rights are inclusive, governments cannot actually affirm universal rights. They can't because they're not a universal system or a world system.
That's a good point.
So important to create a world system of common world law that is universal rights and duties. So that's the meat of the recognition. So it's not always easy. We never want anyone to have a false expectation that if they get this passport or if they show a world citizen card or a world ID card, that it will automatically be recognized. You have to work it, and that's not for everybody. So, we understand that.
So if I were to go to San Diego Airport, mm-hmm. and I presented them my World Authority passport and apparently maybe a visa, depending on what country I'm going to. Right. What have you heard to be the typical response?
Okay, so if you actually have a stamp in your passport and you're only showing your world passport, that, at least as an American, could be problematic. Because in 2009, a law came into effect by the U.S. government that says all U.S. citizens and non-citizen nationals must carry a U.S. passport for air, land, and sea travel out of the country and definitely back in. So what some world passport holders have told us is if they show their U.S. passport and their world passport together and the world passport has a visa, it's not so much of a problem. If they were just to show the world passport, you'd actually potentially be violating the national law. Now, I've also been told that people have been, even in the last few months, been able to leave the United States only on a world passport, especially if they had the visa in it. But they need to know, those people need to know, and this is important, if they try to come back in and they can't prove that they were born here at a minimum, like a state-issued birth certificate, then they could be potentially sent back to whatever country they were last in, which could cause problems for them in that country who doesn't maybe want them back, unless they're a wealthy person who could be spending money, potentially. So, but let me put it another way. We have a legal department, a legal advocacy department, and although we cannot personally represent you as your so-called lawyer, we can advocate on behalf of your human rights. So if you try to leave the San Diego airport and you are rejected and you hopefully will immediately report that back to us to let us know what's happened, we can then immediately jump into a letter writing campaign. We can write to the TSA or the Customs and Border Patrol or the airline. It's a private company and they can sort of, as long as they don't do it in a discriminatory fashion, they can accept or reject anybody if they don't think that you have the paperwork that according to their, company policy states. So right, that's right. Different than a government. A government always has to respect your rights. Yeah. Private companies, they have to respect them in a civil rights way, but they can accept or reject anybody as long as they do it equally for everybody. Yeah. So if you let us know, we will jump into action and start a letter writing campaign, whether it's, to say, look, you should have let this person go. They're going to be coming back again in a week, let them go to see what will happen.
Which can be very effective. I mean, lot of the organizations such as yourself, the letter writing campaigns, folks, is way more effective than people realize because they're not accustomed to us stepping up and proclaiming our own human rights. They just are not used to it. And now the fact that people are actually starting to take action, and I do want to say something before we go on.
Sure.
That is very, very important. It is indicative of this time frame that I was just talking to someone a couple of days ago. We have been so used to the fact that we are, I'm not going to say on the defensive, but we're constantly, at least in the spiritual realm, we're talking about protection. We're talking about cleansing, purifying, purging, extracting. We're constantly trying to clear the darkness. And we are on the flip side of that, okay, where we are, and not that we should stop doing those things, but what I'm saying is we are really being faced as a galactic human world citizen. We are being faced with the reality of how do I go out today and walk my talk that I've been talking about for so long, because it's not going to be anymore about defending, protecting, cleansing, purifying. It's going to be more about recognizing that the darkness and the very dark beings are being removed. Okay, so that overlay and a lot of those programs have been removed. And what does that mean to us? That means that basically a lot of us are just going to sit around twiddling our thumbs if we don't start taking action to create and fill the void of where the darkness ruled. This is prime time to make a difference, because I think it's going to shock people that things are going to get easier and easier and easier. Okay, minions are going to get deprogrammed, as if not already getting deprogrammed. And your very, very dark beings that have been residing on this planet, I've been told pretty much they're all gone. Okay, so we're really in a phase of the distortion and the unraveling of the matrix is happening right now. It is an illusion to think that that is a representation of what is underneath that. What's underneath that is the core of what we want. We are now in the driver's seat. It really is important for people to get that now. We are really transitioning to a totally different phase of our reality. And things like this are such an important, easy first step for us to become a galactic human. That's why I looked at your stuff. I was like, oh my God, I got to do this. Okay. Because I'm going to go out when I travel next, and I'm going to show both of my passports if I need to. Okay. And I'm going to take that first step, and I'm going to educate myself. And I'm sure you have a piece of paper that says, here are all the things that you can say if they give you any slack. Right. You know, what do we have to lose, folks? We got to start somewhere.
Right. Well, I think your point here is that we are, like you said, we're in the driver's seat. We can get the kind of world that not only that we need, but that we want. And we have that power already within us. And I think one of the things I learned over the years working with Gary Davis was that don't just take no for an answer. You, me, everyone, we can go to the top. Whoever we see as that leader up above us, who we feel may be stamping on top of us, we can go to them and make a complaint. We can make a change by reaching out. Like you said, they're surprised that someone actually speaks up.
A quick
fun story of Gary Davis here. He was in Brixton Prison in England when Queen Elizabeth II was being coronated. And so he was like a guest of the queen, the royal court. And he knew this was coming up. Of course, that was all that was in the media at this time. And so he had they gave him paper and a pen or pencil to write things on a day-to-day basis, so he wouldn't just be sitting there twiddling his thumbs. And he wrote a letter to congratulate the queen on her coronation. And he clanked on the bars and said, please come here for a second, to the guard. The guard came over, well, what do you want now? And he's like, well, I've got a letter for the queen. And the guard looked at him, what do you mean you have a letter for the queen? You can't write to the queen, you're in prison. No. And he's like, please, sir, I beseech you. I am here, I feel, as a guest of the queen. I would really appreciate writing her a note to congratulate her on her coronation. That's all it is. It's, and you can read my note. It's a very nice, loving note. He's like, well, I don't know if I can do that. And so finally, Gary, in his inimitable way, convinced the guard to take it. And the guard was like, had the letter in his hand. He was kind of shaking. He's like, oh, well, I'll see what I can do. So he, about a week and a half later, after the coronation, everything was gone. The guard comes with this big smile on his face, and he's like, "Ah, Mr. Davis, look what I have in my hand!" And it was a letter written by not the queen herself, but their queen's secretary, but addressed to S. Gareth Davis, you know, Brixton Prison. And he opened it, and basically was the queen saying, "Thank you, Mr. Davis, for your wonderful, you know, congratulations to me. I'm so proud to be, you know, now in governing, the, not governing, but, you know, governing the country symbolically, you might say." So Gary was, of course, pleased that not only did he attempt that because, he knew that he could, but that he also taught this guard, one other human being, this guard, that you can reach out even to the people who we, like, revere. And they're just humans, right? They're just fellow humans. So we have this power in us. We just have to claim it. That was something that that has carried us well in our legal department when we've had to stand, you might say, I don't like saying, you know, for or against, but it is sort of like up a wall, you might say, against a government to, or at least training them what the rights are that they themselves have agreed to respect, but don't always recognize or want to do. Government says, you know, give lip service to human rights or human consciousness or and all, but they don't always fulfill that in the back meetings, in the secret, you know, back rooms.
David, there are several videos that we blogged where people have successfully stood their ground when they were pulled over, where they just haphazardly pulled them over and said, "We need to check your car." And they said, "I'm sorry, I'm not leaving this car." And they really stood on their rights. And believe it or not, many of them have been let go. And it's right. Because they asserted their rights and the amendments and things. They basically educated themselves. It really wasn't that difficult. And they just kept saying it over and over again. And then the individual that was working with them would go get their manager, okay, or whoever was their superior officer, if you want to call it superior officer. And then they would come to the car and they would stick to their ground. I mean, it's just really amazing. More and more people are doing this. This is what we need to be doing. I wanted you to talk about the International Court. Now, you refer to that in your documentation. Are you familiar with the International Court of Justice?
Sure.
So, okay. How does that fit with what WSA is involved in?
Okay. Well, so right now there are what I would call supranational courts, both regionally and internationally. I wouldn't call it globally because they're really not global courts, although the International Court of Justice is also occasionally called the World Court, but it really is not. It is an international court of justice. That is a court to extract, you would hope, or adjudicate justice between nation states, at least that are members of the United Nations. So you have the International Court of Justice, the ICJ in The Hague. You have the really relatively recently new International Criminal Court, which really is, you might say, a successor to a lot of the ad hoc courts, like the courts for the former Yugoslavia or for Rwanda, even going all the way back to the Nuremberg Tribunal. So we're talking about the idea of you can't just follow an order from a superior, talking about superior, follow an order for a superior when you know that order to be wrong, like killing, you know, an innocent civilian, for example. You have to disobey. And that's what Nuremberg taught us. And so certainly the ICC is a court for individuals, whereas the ICJ is only a court for nation states. Gary Davis actually, he's amazing, he actually petitioned the International Court of Justice as a world nation or world of himself, you know, country to himself, the world. He petitioned them to say, and this was under Reagan and Gorbachev, he said that Gorbachev and Reagan were war criminals or should be sued for pointing nuclear weapons at us, because that was the height of the Cold War, really, the end of the Cold War. And it was really threatening. I remember growing up in the 70s and 80s and being nervous, not like maybe my parents were, who went under desks when there were the big drills, but certainly we had that little bit of awareness of potentiality of a total nuclear destruction. And so he tried, in 1981, he petitioned the ICJ to, you know, basically stop the creation of and then remove all nuclear weapons and material from the planet. But of course, the ICJ rejected that because they said, well, you just don't have jurisdiction. You're an individual human being, go away, basically. Amazing. You're a gadfly, a Socrates figure, go away. So they didn't even hear it, sadly. And now the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which came into existence within the last 10 years or so, they do accept cases of individuals, but it's, of course, it's specifically for international crimes, which are crimes of war, crimes against the peace, crimes against humanity, and genocide. So certainly they should be doing something in Syria, but they've kind of had their hands tied because who do they get their funding from?
Who?
The nation states who are waging the wars. So it's the nation states who pay into that court they kind of have their hands cut, tied behind their back. They can't really do what they should be. And that's why it's an international criminal court, not a world court. So the International Criminal Court, once again, Gary Davis, this was about 3 years before he died, he petitioned the International Criminal Court as an individual to say, look, if there is such a thing as a crime against humanity, that means that humanity must be legal. And if humanity is legal, it has rights and duties, and it should be respected, right? It shouldn't be destroyed by us destroying the environment, by us causing a nuclear war. That could destroy humanity, and that's a crime, right? So he's taking the literal term crime against humanity and say, well, there could be, and that could be total global destruction if we let this happen. So he took the 9 nuclear weapons heads of state to task in a brief that he submitted, a petition that he submitted to the ICC, and asked them to declare that the threat or use of nuclear weapons should be considered illegal, and that needs to end immediately. Now, what could the court have done? The court could have accepted his petition, and if they did, what else could they find but that use of nuclear weapons is illegal? Because in wartime, even under international humanitarian law, which in itself is ridiculous that you have laws to control, how killing is done, but it still allows killing. It doesn't make sense. But anyway, so he asked the court to look at this threat or use of nuclear weapons and declare it illegal. And the court could have said, yes, it's illegal. But the problem was the ICJ, about another 10 years prior to that, in 1996, had actually said in an opinion that the threat or use of nuclear weapons could be used for self-defense. Believe it or not. So the ICJ had already sort of made international law saying that nuclear weapons could potentially be used, which is totally ridiculous anyway. But so the ICC probably felt it could not overrule what the ICJ had already said. It didn't want to reject it. If it had rejected the opinion or the petition of Gary Davis, it would have basically negated itself. Why does it exist if it's not hearing a case about the ultimate crime against humanity? So you know what it did? It ignored it. Even though we got a register return receipt proof that they received this petition, they never replied. So, look, if we can't get justice in the International Court of Justice, if we can't get justice in the International Criminal Court, and even the regional courts, because there are regional courts, there's an American court, an inter-American court, a European court, an African court, there's no court yet for Asia or even the Middle East, but we can't, even regional is not enough to protect the whole world. So even if we got an opinion in a regional court, that's not enough. So it's like, okay, he almost 40 years ago, in 1974, Gary Davis and a man named Lewis Kuttner, who was one of the originators of Amnesty International, who also really created what we now know as the living will, what people do so that, if they can't speak for themselves or whatever else, they put it down on paper what they want to have happen to them, or to their property or whatever, if they can't speak because they're incapacitated or something. He created that. Anyway, this man was an eminent jurist, and he and Gary developed an initial statute for a World Court of Human Rights back in 1974. It did a few little kind of things here and there. Like Lewis Kuttner actually sent a telex, because of course this was way even before faxes back in the 70s, a telex to the head of, was it Uganda? And told this dictator, he said, look, you got this journal. So it was, there was a British journalist who had written something maybe negative about the leader, and he was in Uganda, and the leader's like, you know, put this person in jail. So this man was really jailed arbitrarily. So Lewis Kuttner sent this petition, on World Court of Human Rights stationery, and said, look, you know, we're now issuing a writ of world habeas corpus, meaning that this person should be presented to a court to be able to prove that he is innocent and that he has can exercise his right, a fundamental right to freedom of expression, and should be released immediately. So he sent that, and within a day, this British journalist was released. So this is an example of how just the power of words like World Court of Human Rights, what that can have. An impact on people, you know, who have more supreme power with major weapons, unfortunately.
So what are you doing with the world court? Who comprises that as far as like a council that runs, you know, how does that work?
Right now we have what we have been calling a World Court of Human Rights Development Project. So right now there is no functioning World Court of Human Rights. We have, and I always like to show little things, we have a draft statute, a new statute, which took the old statute, revised it up to sort of the present day and beyond, with some interesting ways to hold governments accountable, even if this were not a treaty, or even if it were a treaty among governments, to hold them accountable where, like, the International Criminal Court or the ICJ does not. So we have this development project. There's a one particular lawyer, but there's been several different lawyers involved in meetings online, meetings that we've had over the last 3 or 4 years to develop this new statute, to discuss it. I've done with the American Bar Association here in the United States an online, not exactly a webinar, but a discussion for about an hour about it. I've written about it in my blog. Mark, this attorney in Vermont, who became a friend of Gary Davis when, this is a whole other long story, which I won't go into, but he became a friend of Gary Davis when he represented Gary for having brought in a Native American back into America from Canada. Basically, the U.S. government considered illegally when it wasn't. But anyway, so he became friends with Gary, and then he loved the idea of the World Court of Human Rights. We sent him to India for the last 4 years. We sent him to India because they have a Chief Justice Conference every either October or December. And they meet at the largest public school in the world, which is the City Montessori School in Lucknow, India. So not only is Mark Ottinger, the attorney, meeting with these thousands of students, because there's like, I don't know, 20,000 students at this school, he's also meeting with government leaders in the government of India, and he's speaking at these events. And he was able to, I think it was at the end of 2014, get a unanimous resolution at the end of this Chief Justice Conference, and there's about 150 or so Chief Justices of all the Supreme Courts of the countries of the world in attendance, to get a resolution that said we do need and we need to create immediately a World Court of Human Rights. So with that, you might say, juridical support and basis, we have been now trying to do fundraising to and get technical and legal support for this. We actually have a Survey Monkey survey where anyone in the world, you don't have to be a lawyer, you don't have to be a jurist, you could be a child, it doesn't really matter. We want to hear, you know, without much education about the law, it doesn't matter. We want anyone with an interest in global justice, justice for the earth, justice for humanity, justice for the universe, you might say, to participate in this survey, letting us know whether you think it's a good idea that a fully functioning World Court of Human Rights should or should not exist. I mean, it tries to leave the questions open so that, you know, we're not saying, oh, yes, there needs to be this court. Well, yeah, we are saying that. But in the questions, it asks, well, do you think there should be? Because we want to get everyone's viewpoint. Because some people say, well, I really do, but make sure it doesn't do this, obviously. Yeah. You know, don't make sure it doesn't trample on my rights in this way. And this is really important. So I have to say, we're really at the extreme very beginning, even though this has been in existence in some form since 1974, we're in the very extreme beginning of me as the convener of a World Court of Human Rights coalition, me as the director of this World Court of Human Rights Development Project, and Mark Ottinger, this other attorney, working on. He's just for the Vermont State Bar Association written an article for their bar journal. We're going to use that article for the American Bar Association has some really preeminent human rights journals that we're going to put the article in that, revise it and add to it. And then we're hopefully going to have a webinar about this so people can really understand what we've been doing already. And then really, as anything, whether it's World Service Authority, whether it's Galactic Connection, for us to get the word out, sadly, it requires money. Maybe not this money, but it requires some kind of money. And that's something else we could talk about if you want. But we unfortunately, you know, you have to grease the wheels of the technologists or the businesses or whatever who help us to do what we need to do, whether it's paying SurveyMonkey several hundred dollars a year just to keep the survey up.
Right.
Or whatever. People, you know, you need to exchange one way or another.
We understand. We're still in that reality where
dollar
bill pays our rent and our mortgages and our grocery bills.
Exactly, sadly.
Well, I'm very interested in that. I'd like you to keep me posted on that.
Sure.
I'd love to assist you in any way I can with that, seriously.
Oh, well, thank you.
Regarding the passports and anything else that people submit information to you, is it kept privately?
Yes, this is really, there's two important points to what you just asked. One, we do not maintain a list that we would share with people. We have a database, of course, but we don't share that data with anybody unless we are required, like under threat or actual subpoena by law, to share because someone has actually harmed somebody. And this has happened in the past. I mean, I can't tell you how many FBI, CIA, Interpol, we even once had some Belgian immigration officers come to our office. I mean, every couple months, somebody comes from some, what I like to call the control authority. If you ever watched the show Get Smart, there was chaos and control. Well, anyway, the control authority.
Really accurate. That's really accurate.
There's the control authority, and they come, and that's fine. We work with any legitimate control authority because we don't want someone using the world passport for ill-gotten gains or to harm somebody. Obviously, that's a violation of human rights, so of course we work with them. But we don't share, we don't sell data to anybody. We don't share it. And up until recently, we haven't even been reaching out. Once you get a world passport, you might not hear from us again. Ever, unless you contact us. I mean, you might hear by an email potentially, but we actually are probably going to start doing that soon, actually starting to at least email, not call or something, but email people to say, look, this is our next campaign. Do you want to help in some way? Yeah. Not even necessarily monetarily. So the privacy is utmost concern because everyone is concerned about, especially this day and age with computer cyber crime and hacking. No, we take that really serious responsibility of that. But then there's another aspect to, not so much to privacy, but you might say respect of the law and concern for the welfare of others. And that is, we have a compliance program, which pretty much in countries that require this, and everyone should have. I mean, and that is not just us as an organization, but even the individuals, because individuals don't know about this law. But there's a law that says that if you're interacting with certain people, you better check first to make sure that they are not a terrorist, a trafficker, or weapons of mass destruction, or otherwise blocked. So there's something called the Office of Foreign Assets Control. It's part of the U.S. Department of Treasury, and I'm not here to give them a commercial, but I'm here to say that we follow what we have to by law, which means that everyone who applies, we have to check various watch lists to make sure that those persons aren't known criminals. Now, there may be people who aren't known criminals who might be, who could potentially do something heinous later on, but, you know, we wouldn't know about that. Maybe the FBI or whoever wouldn't know about that. And, you know, you can't control what you don't know in the long run anyway. But so you don't know what's, we don't have a, like in Minority Report, a Bureau of Pre-Crime that can tell us, you know, someone's going to do something. At least I'm not aware of it. Maybe you are. But so anyway, my point is, we do our compliance check on every single person going these various lists. And the sad thing I have to say, and this is a really sad part for me, as someone who loves other people and humanity and wants everybody to have all their rights, there are certain groups of people, just because of where they live, that we cannot help. So there's people in Syria, that's a fully blocked country. Wow. People in Iran, people in Sudan, Somalia, North Korea, these are Cuba still. These are, when I say fully blocked, that means us as an organization or even me as an individual. I cannot send money, I cannot send a document like a passport or something to someone there. That will be considered illegal. We could be fined $500,000. We could go to be shut down, or I could go to jail. So we have to do that compliance. But what's really sad about that, although there is, and I should, you know, give the opposite side to it, there is a way to get a, what's called a license, a special license, to be able to help people in those countries. So there are, and the reason why you can see Red Cross and other people helping people actually in Syria is because they've gotten a special humanitarian license to do it. But for, so quick example, there was an Iranian woman who was married to a man, which for her was a problem because she was gay. She didn't want to be married to a man, but not only was it a man, but it was her cousin. So there was the issue of, you know, being a relative, issue of being a man. But in Iran, you could be stoned to death for being gay. So she reached out to us through a friend in Germany. We didn't even know it was coming from Iran. Once we found out that she was actually living in Iran, so it doesn't matter that she's Iranian, it's that it's where she's actually located.
Okay.
We could not help her immediately. So what we did is we applied for a special license. It took about a year and a half, believe it or not. She could have been dead by then. But finally, we got this special license that allowed us to issue her for free a world passport, send it to her through her friend in Germany, who was then able to get it to her there, so that she could hopefully... on the sly, you might say, in secret, leave while her husband wasn't paying attention. Because in certain countries, I don't know if you're aware of this, but the husband controls the wife's ability to leave.
Right.
She,
yes.
You know, that a woman, if it's married to a man, can't even leave if without the husband's permission. So this was one, you know, sort of humanitarian effort that we had just to help just one person, where we wouldn't normally have been able to do it unless we got that special license. So there's the privacy side of it. There's the security or safety side of it. We never want anyone getting a world passport who's going to do something wrong. We don't always know, though, if a person is not on some special watch list, and we, you know, we look at them. So
no, well, you got to do what you got to do to work within.
We work within and without the system. You're right.
Right. Within, just to get the job done, you know?
Yes. Exactly.
So we have about 15 minutes, and what I wanted you to do was to share, if you could, just really quickly, how did this man, Gary, and it's Gary Davis, right?
Yes.
How did this man impact you in the way that this is all you do now, is human rights? Were you on this path before you met him?
Yes. I mean, I'm a kind of a, which may be a negative thing to say, I'm kind of a diplomatic person. I like getting along. I like, I mean, I, once when I was really young, I thought, ooh, I could be maybe Secretary General of the UN or something like that. Where I, like a diplomat working to bring
you
people
like
together.
Peacemaking.
I'm that kind of person. I like people to get along.
Sure.
So I had that mentality even as a little kid. At one point, I wanted to be an architect. And my seventh grade art teacher said to me, David, there's not even going to be a world to build when you grow up. Why do you want to be an architect? Which really, when you're in seventh grade, when he said that to me, I don't know what where this must have been channeled from somewhere. I don't know where this came from. But I said to him, well, then I'll build a new one.
Right on.
So and where did that come from? A seventh grader. You're right. Sure. There had to be some being out there giving me that information. So anyway, and I feel like at World Service Authority that what we do on a day-to-day basis is not to tear down, not to take away the nation state, but to move beyond it. Gary Davis would always say that the problem is not the nation state itself. It's the anarchy that exists between those states. That is the problem. It's the anarchy that allows war. It's the anarchy that allows oppression and disrespect of rights. It's that anarchy, and that's why you need to put law. I mean, peace isn't the absence of war. It's the presence of law.
Yeah.
So certainly I studied French and history in undergrad, and when you study history, you learn about the problems and mistakes of the past. And when I studied abroad in France, that opened a whole new culture and community. And when I studied abroad in France at that point, it was very liberal. I mean, not like it is now. It was very liberal. There was, you know, still a lot of communism and socialism going on in the country. And that opened my mind because, of course, grew up in a capitalist society here in America. That really opened my mind. In fact, my culture shock was not when I went to France. It was when I came back here. Mm-hmm. I'm like, whoa, look at all these big cars. Look at all this waste. Look at, and, you know, it was.
Yeah, Europe is very much more, because of the world wars.
Right.
Europe is so much more conscientious about the way they use their resources.
Yes.
I definitely saw that when I was over there as well.
Yeah. So I became attuned to the, you know, sort of difference and diversity. And then I decided to go into law in graduate school. So that's what brought me to Washington, D.C., studying law here as well as getting a degree in international relations. And so, but when I got out of law school, I had worked at the International Human Rights Clinic, which you mentioned, and I really enjoyed representing these people in a refugee situation and getting them asylum. But I didn't know what to do. I wanted to be able to use my French speaking capabilities. I wanted to use my law. But it was very hard time. This was like 1991, and the economy was really pretty bad. Maybe not as bad as it was in 2008, but it was really still pretty bad. And I had lawyer friends who were just doing part-time legal research just to pay some bills and to pay back for law school. So I told everyone I knew I needed a job. I actually had a friend who worked at the Nature Conservancy, and she had a friend at work whose sister used to work at World Service Authority. And I had just written a paper for one of my master's degree classes about how I thought there should be a united world organization. So when I heard about this job at World Service Authority, opening their legal department and actually creating a legal department for the organization, I'm like, wow, that's for me. This is really intriguing. I had never heard of Gary Davis. I'd never heard of a world government or world citizens. What is that? How could there be a world government that I've never heard of? You know, so it really intrigued me. And I gave them my paper as a sample of my writing. And Gary Davis really liked the idea that I already sort of had this idea of the world coming together. And then that's a whole other long story about my first interview with the previous president of the organization and with Gary. But it was really a joy ride, literally, with working with Gary for about 23 years up until when he died. And because every day I come in here with a list of, I come with my legal pad with a list of, 10 things that I want to get on, or maybe only five now, if I'm trying to be reasonable. Right. And if I get even one of those things on that list done, I am so happy because, it's so interesting to work here because every day people come into our office because we're an office that does welcome people. We're really a working office, but we do have a small foyer where people can come and meet with us. So we do welcome the world to our office. But it's so fun meeting with people who, either were friends of Gary's from, the 1940s or students who are just interested in the idea of world citizenship or the refugee who comes in. Once we had a refugee from Algeria who came in and said, "Hi, I'm here." We're like, "Yes, how can we help you?" And he's like, "Well, I know about you. I just got off I'm a merchant marine from Algeria, but I'm really afraid to go back to Algeria. Can I stay here?" So that day I had to pull like $5 out of my wallet to give him money because he was literally off the boat and had nothing but his clothes on his back. We issued him a world passport so he'd have ID. We immediately had to find him a shelter where he could live. And then we finally were working with a lawyer at a different organization to help him take his asylum case actually into the courts in town. So I love working with Gary Davis. I really feel honored and privileged to have worked with him. With a man, not just because he was world famous, because when I met him first, I didn't know really that he was world famous until later on. And he didn't act that way. He was so down to earth, such a person who, if you were willing to listen, so easy to talk to. Because I talk a lot. He talks even more. But he was challenging, I would say. And that's another reason why I like this job, because it has been challenging. He was challenging to me and to everybody, because he is that sort of Socratic figure where you might say something, like sometimes I would say, they think that this should be this way. And Gary's like, "Who is they? I want to know what you think, not they, whoever they are." So Gary would always put me in my place, which is really good. But he would do it, as he got older. I mean, he had some rough edges, and that's because he had some indignity. He had rage, which you're hearing from me right now, but maybe through a smile. He had rage in his life, even right up until the day he died. He had rage about this system that killed his brother, that made him kill. I mean, just a classic example of the story of his ongoing rage that he put into like positive light. Like you said, about 4 days before he died, they had to put him in a hospice. And he was walking with his canes, because he had a cane in each hand, down the front steps of what he called World Government House, which was his home in Burlington. It was also our publishing house. Anyway, he was walking down the steps with a really lovely woman who was taking care of him, and then to the ambulance. And in his hand, he had a copy of the Declaration of Human Rights to give to the ambulance driver to say, "Look, I'm almost out of this world, but you're still in it. Take this declaration, learn about your rights, and claim them." I mean, this is on his way to his death.
Amazing man. Amazing. Yes. I mean, what an honor to have had him as a teacher.
Oh, yeah. He's been he would say he was, as a guru. he really was a wisdom giver. I really learned so much about looking at the world around us holistically and not just one. He would say that world citizenship is like the equal sign, that if you can be that equal sign, you can see what's on the left and right of that equation and understand it. You can be the peacemaker by being in that center and seeing the whole equation. Wow. And that's a lovely way of looking at
it. Very much so. Beautiful. And so you worked with him for 23 years, did you say?
Yes. Yeah, and I've been here about 25 years. Yeah.
That's amazing. It sounds to me almost, what I saw was that this was your destiny. You know, it was like the door just opened up. It's like, hey, David, hey, knock, knock.
Come on.
Here's your destiny, bud.
Exactly.
Look at where you are now. Now you're about to create a whole world court.
Yes.
That is outside of this international jurisdiction that can truly make some changes and differences. I mean, how fabulous is that?
Yeah. So, well, I'm so excited to be doing this.
Oh my gosh. You know, and I feel the same way. It's, you know, when you really step into your passion and you don't focus on the what ifs and you don't focus on the fear. Oh gosh, well, if I did that, then this is going to happen. And you just know that the universe has your back.
Exactly.
Especially when you're doing it for all of us on the planet. And trust me, I mean, David being the same, you know, we don't do this stuff every day just because it's all about us. We do it because we really love and care about our world, our fellow, you know, humans, our fellow citizens, you know, our animals.
The trees. I mean, the trees have rights.
The tree, you know, yeah. It's like that. When you see everything that way, your whole world just blossoms.
Yes.
And so many incredible opportunities come into your world. So before you go, can you just give us an idea of, we got about 5 minutes or so. Can you give us an idea of like a really cool case that you've worked on that you were victorious in as a boy?
So there was, and of course I can't say names. Once again,
sure.
It's privacy.
Totally understand.
There was a man living in Jerusalem who was Palestinian. He was working for an Israeli restaurant owner. One day he happened to see some children, Palestinian children, writing epithets on a wall, you know, violent epithets on a wall. And he reported it to his boss. And the boss reported it to the local police chief. And the local police chief was like, ha, 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 this is important, this is good. You know, and what he did was he met, you know, the restaurant owner said, you know, look, you've got to the young man who, you know, who worked for him at the restaurant. You've got to, you know, the police chief is going to come by to say thank you. And he thought that's all it was. But the police chief basically came by to say, look, now that you've been so helpful, we really appreciate that. And, you know, look, hey, you've got a work permit. If you want to renew that work permit, we'd like you to continue doing this. So it was like, you know, an offer you can't refuse, sort of twisting, I feel like, you know, coercion, twisting his arm. And so he's like, okay, because he, you know, he was sending money back, I guess, to his family, and he had to survive himself.
Oh,
so, he did report some more events like this going on. But unfortunately, he was then kidnapped, taken into Palestinian territory, and was being tortured and being jailed because he was like a Benedict Arnold, you might say. He was considered a traitor by the Palestinians, which you can understand because, like, why is reporting on the Palestinian youth or feeling oppressed and writing something on a wall, you know? So anyway, he was there for a while. We hadn't even heard about this at this case at this point. And his mother, you know, was desperately trying to help him. She was able to find a lawyer from Israel, though, who was able to meet with him. And they came out with a really, I don't know, amazing plan to secret him out of Israel or out of Palestine. And they were able to get him, like, I guess the Palestinians were going to give him, like, a day off to see his family. And it was then that they got him to the airport. He flew over and he ended up in, you know, the south of the United States. And once again, I'm leaving out certain personal.
Sure, you should.
So anyway, and that's when he came to us. And he's like, look, I've got this lawyer. This lawyer is really not helping me. He's not doing his job. It's egregious the way this lawyer was not trying to help him. And I mean, you know, some lawyers are overworked and, you know, it's frustrating. But so we're like, why don't we write a legal brief, what's called an amicus curiae, a friend of the court brief on your behalf to support your right to be in the United States. And what's so cool about this brief, you know, refugee status is based upon your persecution that you suffered due to your race, your religion, your nationality, your political opinion, or your social group. Well, he was, you know, part of it was his nationality. He was Palestinian, and he wouldn't be safe going back to Israel. But it was also his nationality. He wouldn't be safe going back to Palestine because they didn't want him either. He was a traitor, right? He wouldn't be safe anywhere there in the Middle East. So that was one of our arguments. And then also our argument was social group, that he was like a former informant. And now as a former informant, where could he be safe? He couldn't be. And this argument won over the court, and he got asylum. I was so pleased. And if we hadn't submitted that, because the lawyer were basically, they hadn't really done any preparation and basically handed in our brief at the hearing. And so it's that kind of case. I mean, just let me put another quick story. There was a woman in here yesterday from Angola. She waited about 7 years to try to get her green. She'd been here for 7 years. She kept applying for a green card, reapplying for a permanent residence, never getting it. She was mistakenly put on a terrorist-related inadmissibility grounds list just because she was a refugee from Angola. And so she mistakenly got put on this list. So 7 years into it, we heard about it. We wrote a letter to the immigration ombudsman, and which is like they oversee immigration to make sure that they're doing their job properly. And they accepted that sort of petition. And then we helped her this was just in the middle of this last year, 2016. We helped her with a letter to explain on one of the forms that you have to fill out for immigration, why this ground didn't matter. And then within 2 months, once we had first contacted the ombudsman and then written this next letter, within 2 months, she got her green card. And she came in, it's been about 6 months now. She finally, because she works day and night, she's trying to survive. But so this was the first time she had a day off, she told me. And she's like, David, I wanted to come in here and give you a handshake. Thank you so much. And she wrote us a letter that said, thank you so much, World Service Authority, for what you did for me personally. And she doesn't even have a world passport. We help people, whether you have our documents or not. If we can help you, if it's a human rights matter, we want to help. And that's why I'm so proud of this organization. People don't see that. You look us up on the net and you might see unusual, interesting, or horrible things just because there is that pushback against what we're trying to do, which is revolutionary. People don't like change or don't want the change because they're in power and they want to keep it. So I'm so proud to be able to do what we do here and love to do it.
And you know what? Bless you from my heart for all that you're doing. We are all appreciative of what you're doing because it takes people like you to have the stick-to-itiveness to continue on with your vision, your goal, your dream. I am so grateful. And again, please, everyone, check out his website. It's worldservice.org. And his name is David Gallup. And maybe we'll have him back in so we can go over some other really cool. There's so much to cover when you talk about the world. This is kind of a preliminary thing to get our feet wet. But just so you know, I mean, you have the World Refuge Fund, the World Citizen Legal Fund, Human Rights Court Project, Human Rights Awareness Project, World Citizen Referendum, World Peace Guards, which I didn't even get into, World Birth Card Project, World Citizen Forum, World Media Association. I mean, the list goes on. If you don't feel like I do that this is definitely a very important piece of our transition and bringing us to more of a galactic perspective on the surface of this planet, I don't know what to say. But as always, thank you so much, David. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in to Galactic Connection. We do air this on Tuesday afternoons from 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Station 2. As always, please support us. We provide the ongoing 365 days a year newsletter and the blog itself. We do at least 25 posts a day, focusing on everything from spirituality, conspiracy, political situations, anthropology, archaeology, galactic history, you name it. We're really trying to sift through a ton of information to provide you the truth and doing it through a galactic and spiritual eye. So please check us out and also look at all of our services. We have some amazing services that we have just come out with, such as the Divine Blueprint Reset, the Guardian Protection Initiation, the Aligning with Sophia, My Galactic Essences. There's going to be some more of that coming out. We also have the new Intrusion Removal Process, which is for all of you out there, super soldiers, my labs, my lab victims. I hate to use the word victim. Let me see, satanic ritual, that kind of thing. We're finally coming up with a solution for that, so I'm really excited about that. So stay tuned. Sending you lots of love from my heart to yours, and you guys take care, stay warm, and stay dry. And thank you, David.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.